I'm VOA's Joe Ramsey with your worldwide news update. A rights group on Thursday said Israel has caused a forced displacement of civilians in Gaza to such an extent that it constitutes war crimes and crimes against humanity. Reuters correspondent Zachary Goldman reports.
Israel claims that it set up an evacuation system to allow Palestinians, civilians in Gaza to seek safety.
Human Rights Watch said its investigation showed that Israel failed to show its efforts to relocate Palestinian civilians met the required conditions under international law. Adam Kugel is the deputy director of the group's Middle East and North Africa division.
Our report and documentation shows that Israel has failed to meet the burden. Therefore, they are committing forced displacement, and because it's pursuant to a state policy, it is a crime against humanity.
Israel, in response, accused the organization of using rhetoric that is, quote, completely false and detached from reality. Israel invaded the Gaza Strip last year after Hamas gunmen led an assault on communities in southern Israel, killing around 1,200 people, according to Israeli authorities, and abducting more than 250 as hostages. Since then, the Israeli campaign has killed more than 43,500 people, according to Gaza health authorities. The onslaught destroyed much of the enclave's infrastructure, forcing most of the population's 2.3 million people to move several times. For the past month, Israeli troops have moved tens of thousands of people from areas of Gaza's north, as they have sought to destroy Hamas forces the military says are regrouping. Human Rights Watch said the displacement of Palestinians, quote, is likely planned to be permanent in the buffer zones and security corridors, an action it said would amount to, quote, ethnic cleansing. The Israeli military has denied seeking to create permanent buffer zones. Foreign Minister Gideon Saar said on Monday that Palestinians displaced from their homes in northern Gaza would be allowed to return at the end of the war.
Reuters correspondent Zachary Goldman, this is VOA News. U.S. President-elect Donald Trump says he'll nominate vaccine skeptic Robert F. Kennedy Jr. to be America's health secretary. AP correspondent Sagar Magani reports.
Kennedy would head the massive Health and Human Services Department, which oversees everything from drug, vaccine, and food safety to Medicare.
We will make Americans healthy again.
Kennedy endorsed Trump in August after dropping his own independent presidential bid. The son of the late Attorney General is one of the world's most prominent anti-vaccine activists and has long advanced the debunked idea that vaccines cause autism. During a House hearing, California Democrat Robert Garcia was aghast.
That someone that wants to gut the NIH, HHS, and other services could be put in charge of health of any kind in this country.
Sagar Magani, Washington.
Smog has descended on New Delhi earlier than usual this year, impacting visibility, including near the Indian city's international airport. Reuters correspondent Rachel Graham has more.
Smog caused a sharp drop in visibility in Delhi this week, causing a raft of delays at the city's airport. More patients flocked to hospitals, particularly children. One pediatrician told a news agency he'd seen a spike in asthma attacks. Officials blamed high pollution, combined with humidity, low wind speed, and a slight drop in temperature. Daily air quality in the region crossed into the severe category for the first time this season. Air quality monitoring group IQ Air ranked New Delhi the second most polluted major city on Thursday, behind Lahore in neighboring Pakistan. Dense smog has engulfed other parts of northern India, such as the states of Punjab and Uttar Pradesh, where visibility fell to zero in some areas on Thursday.
Reuters correspondent Rachel Graham. China's president will unveil a megaport in Peru, but locals say they're being left out. AP correspondent Charles de Ledesma reports.
Chancay is a remote fishing town on the edge of Peru's coastal desert, where a third of all residents have no running water, but is now being transformed into a huge deep water port to cash in on the inexorable rise of Chinese interests in resource-rich South America. Local fisherman Julio Cesare tells the AP all kinds of fish used to come. They destroyed an appropriated part of the sea. The megaport, a 1.3 billion dollar project, majority owned by the Chinese shipping giant Cosco, wants to turn the outpost of bobbing fishing boats into an important node of the global economy. I'm Charles Tillesma.
That wraps up this update, but the world and news never stop. For additional updates, visit our website. I'm Joe Ramsey, VOA News.
Good morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Buckley in Washington. Today is Friday, November 15th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Stark differences over financing are emerging at the UN Climate Change Summit, also called COP29.
Countries like Kenya haven't contributed to the problem. Why would you transfer responsibility to them of cutting emissions? Actually, we do not have emissions to cut.
Mozambique's political unrest is costing the southern African region. An estimated 4,000 illegal miners remain trapped inside a closed mine in South Africa's northwest province. Vote counting from Wednesday's breakaway Somaliland's presidential election continues. We'll have an analysis. Roman Catholic bishops in Kenya criticized President Ruto's government for what they called unexplained killings and abductions.
The bishops came out to tell President William Ruto to take action and stop the ongoing abduction of Kenyans who are criticizing his administration.
And Nigeria launches Human Rights Defenders Forum. Those stories plus Thompson O'Malley's posts are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Stark differences over financing are emerging at the United Nations Climate Change Summit, also called COP29, now underway in Baku, Azerbaijan. This year, the key issue is how to fund poorer countries to help them curb planet warming gases and to cope with the impacts of climate change. Darren Taylor reports.
Eden Duale is at COP29 as Kenya's Environment Cabinet Secretary. During an online panel at the climate summit on Thursday, he said there's too much talk about what Africa should do to stop burning fossil fuels, such as coal. Instead, there first should be more discussion about wealthy nations cutting their fossil fuel use and helping Africa cut in the future.
Countries like Kenya haven't contributed to the problem. Why would you transfer responsibility to them of cutting emissions? Actually, we do not have emissions to cut. What we have here is to avoid future emissions. And that's why we are calling on the global players. Even if you cut emissions in your own country and leave us dependent on fossil fuel, you are not solving the problem.
Highly industrialized nations acknowledge they've contributed the most to climate change because the gases they've emitted trap heat in the Earth's atmosphere. This causes weather patterns to change. Rains at times are heavier than usual, causing flooding. Hotter, drier conditions lead to intense droughts. The poor in Africa pay the heaviest price when their crops fail and their homes are destroyed. Wealthy nations have pledged $100 billion a year to help less developed countries build infrastructure that's more resilient to extreme weather and to fund renewable energy systems. But they acknowledge that isn't enough. African countries say they need more than $1 trillion every year. However, there's no sign of consensus about this, says Duale, and time is running out.
We all of us have to move in a collective action. And since we do not have much resources to invest in the potential that we have in terms of renewables and all that, that's why we need this international cooperation, a framework that is going to make available these resources for Kenya to invest in its renewables, to invest in its arable land for food sovereignty, for energy sovereignty, to help Kenyan people and African people to be able to overcome the challenges presented to them by climate.
He's concerned that some rich countries want to evade their responsibilities by controlling global carbon emission markets. These were established after the International Climate Agreement reached in 1997. These markets put a price tag on carbon emissions. They reward nations and businesses that reduce their emissions and create financial penalties for those that continue to pollute the atmosphere. In Baku, African delegates are frustrated that the leaders of the 13 largest carbon-polluting countries are not attending. Many delegates say this complicates efforts to create a comprehensive climate financing agreement. For VOA News, I'm Darren Taylor in Johannesburg.
Post-election unrest in Mozambique is expected to be on the agenda at the coming Southern African Development Community's Extraordinary Heads of State Summit. Regional leaders are expected to address the scores of civilian fatalities and injuries since the ruling Frelimo party declared Daniel Chapo president with over 70% of the vote in the October 9 election. Veki Stark reports.
Earlier this week, Venancio Mondlane, leader of the opposition Podemos Party, called for even more protests over the October election results. Police have used brutal force to crack down on thousands of his supporters who've taken to the streets since the announcement in favor of election winner Daniel Tapong. Here's analyst Willem Els of the Institute for Security Studies.
Mondlane had to flee Mozambique. He's somewhere in a neighboring country, and we suspect that he's in South Africa, because his life is severely in danger.
Els describes some of the damage done by pro-Mondlane demonstrators at the border post a week ago. It has since been closed intermittently.
They burned down the border post as well as immigration, everything on the Rusana Garcia site at the Lubombo border post with South Africa. They then kept about 1,000 trucks that were at Mile 4 where they had to clear customs at ransom. And what happened then is they looted some of these trucks, but they also burned down at least one of the trucks.
South Africa's Commissioner of the Border Management Authority, Michael Masiapato, issued a statement Thursday morning.
We have resumed operations, especially the processing of cargo to the Mozambican side, after they had confirmed to us that the situation had stabilized and therefore the corridor is ready to receive the export cargo from the South African side into Maputo.
Masiapato confirmed that they are also processing people at the border.
But the majority of the people we are processing are Mozambicans that are returning back to their country, as well as South Africans that are returning back to South Africa. On that basis, we would like to still discourage South Africans from going into Mozambique for holiday purposes, primarily because the situation still remains volatile.
Cross-border analyst Cage Barnett, who is an affiliate of the Southern Africa Association of Freight Forwarders, says the unrest is costing the region millions.
South Africa is one of the main producers of chrome in the world. So there is a huge amount of ore that goes along that corridor, as well as mining equipment. There's food, fuel.
He says they've been told that the military has been placed along the route, but he says truck drivers are nervous.
The last thing you want is to be facing a protesting crowd that could potentially not only cause damage to your vehicle, but also yourself.
Regional leaders of the Southern African Development Community, who have been criticized for taking too long to respond to the crisis, are slated to meet in Harare November 16th through 20th in an extraordinary session to discuss possible solutions. The regional bloc may decide to deploy its panel of elders, comprising former heads of state, to mediate between the government, opposition, and all other stakeholders. Vicky Stark, VOA News, Cape Town, South Africa.
Roman Catholic bishops in Kenya have criticized President William Ruto's government for what they called unexplained killings, abductions, and disappearances, especially the murders of women in the country. The Kenya Conference of Catholic Bishops made their claims on Thursday during a news conference. Kenyan government officials were not immediately available to comment, but the Kenya police released a statement reiterating their commitment to serve and protect all Kenyans. I asked Barak Uduad, political reporter with the People's Daily of Kenya, just what else did the Catholic bishops have to say?
The Kenya Conference of Catholic Bishops today addressed Kenyans, and they were particularly not pleased with President William Ruto's administration. They raised several issues about President William Ruto, among them the issue of police killings in the country. Like for a period of the last 3-4 months, there has been continued abductions and killings, especially targeting people who are not pleased or people who are critical to President William Ruto. So the bishops came out to tell President William Ruto to take action and stop the ongoing abductions of Kenyans who are criticizing his administration. Remember, since the protests that were organized by youths in Kenya against raising of taxes. There has been continued abductions, and in most instances, young people have been found dead, especially after those abductions.
I did receive a statement from the Kenyan police, and I'm sure you have also received it. What exactly are the police saying in response to the Catholic bishop's statement?
Yes, the police have come out to deny that there have been part and parcel of abductions and killings of Kenyans who are not happy with President William Ruto. In fact, if you look at what the police have brought out as their response, they are saying that on their hand, at least it's only 42 people who have died during the protest against President William Ruto's government. And they are also saying that 347 Kenyans were injured. And also they are saying that 29 persons are still missing. Remember, the police have denied any knowledge of abductions targeting Kenyans who are not happy with President William Ruto. So they were vehemently denying all what the bishops were claiming.
What does this mean, and what are Kenyans saying about what the bishops said?
The issue of the Kenyan Conference of Catholic Bishops issuing a press conference or statement on President William Ruto's administration has brought a big, sharp division in Kenya currently as we are speaking. There are President William Ruto's friends or allies or government officials who have condemned the bishops, telling them to keep off from criticizing President William Ruto, while majority of Kenyans in social media platforms such as X, Facebook, TikTok and the rest, they are supporting the bishops. Politicians from the opposition are also supporting the bishops.
Barack Udua is the political reporter for the People Daily of Kenya. He was speaking with us from the Kenyan capital, Nairobi. You are listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Barton in Washington. Today is Friday, November 15th. For more Africa news and features, visit our website at voaafrica.com. Connect with us on all social media platforms. We are on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. Still to come on our program, Samson O'Malley Sports. An estimated 4,000 illegal miners have been trapped in an abandoned mine in South Africa's northwest province since October 18. Authorities said Thursday that they have blocked off the entrances used to deliver supplies to discourage unregulated mining, according to several news reports. Professor Sipo Sipe is a political analyst and a former deputy vice chancellor for institutional support at the University of Zululand. He tells me that while illegal mining is a nuisance in South Africa, he hopes that the authorities will honor the constitutional right to life.
It's been an ongoing challenge for South Africa to deal with illegal mining. So this does not come as a surprise. But what is strange is more the extent of it, that you could have close to about 4,000 people underground. But there's some of those, we have had the experiences of them in Johannesburg. And there were all things that made government very unhappy, and that's why it's taken a firm stand, is that some of them are led by people who are very armed, so armed to the teeth that the police are scared to stop the whole illegal mining, and hence the posture taken by the minister in the presidency.
I know that the authorities are saying that they will not send food and water. How do they feed themselves if they are on the ground there?
Well, that's why it has created a catastrophe, because they've always had the supply. Now, with the police having cordoned the area and making sure that those supplies, they are hoping that the absence of supplies will force them to get out. And so far, they're saying about 1,000 of those illegal miners have actually started to resurface. And some of them are afraid, or all of them are afraid, because this is an illegal act, because those mines are not for mining. They're closed. And illegal mining means that once they get out, they'll be arrested. So some of them are trying to find a way of getting out without being arrested. But this is where the dilemma is.
How serious is this illegal mining in South Africa?
Well, it's very serious. I mean, it's an industry on its own that reeks about a billion or more than a billion rands. And this is money that ordinarily would have to be go through the system. But what it does is create a black market. But the other countries have dealt it with differently, have actually tried to offer licenses to these people so that it is regulated. And then when you do that, then you allow what you call artisanal mining, or the miners who are not really the big players to start engaging. But at the moment, South Africa has not adopted that position.
Is it likely the government or the authorities could change their mind to help them?
Well, I think they will change their mind. There's so much pressure from the people in this country.
Professor Sipho Sipho is a political analyst and a former deputy vice chancellor for institutional support at the University of Zululand. He was speaking with us from Johannesburg. Vote counting from Wednesday's breakaway Somaliland's presidential election continues. Somaliland, legally part of Somalia, unilaterally declared independence in 1993, but has not been recognized by any sovereign state. To find out what Somaliland's presidential election means for Somalia, viewers Douglas Mpuga reached political analyst David Monda.
That means Somaliland continues to be a major threat to seceding from Somalia. With peaceful elections in Somaliland, this, I think, is another big positive for Somaliland's claim to want to be independent. And I think Somalia will be looking at this situation very, very closely, particularly also in light of the agreement signed between Ethiopia and Somaliland around port access, and also Somaliland's efforts to have recognition from the international community. So these elections are part of that broader framework of Somaliland trying to become independent from Somalia.
With this changing geopolitics around the world, do you think now Somaliland may have a chance of being recognized?
I think that really depends on the interest from major powers, because the global system is really dominated by the will of the powerful and the strong countries. So if we take, for example, the case of recognition of Kosovo, Kosovo became independent because the European Union and the United States wanted an independent Kosovo separate from, you know, Serbian aggression. That appetite has just not been there in the case of Somaliland to this point. So that might change. But there is pressure from the African Union, I think, and many African countries generally, not to have Somaliland break away from Somalia in relation to the long-established president of the OAU to respect colonial boundaries as modern nation-state boundaries, and also that consensus within the AU. But these dynamics can change. So if the new Trump administration sees value in an independent Somaliland, if the U.S. pushes hard on that, things might change depending on whether the Russians or the Chinese might oppose that. But at this point, I still think it's difficult for Somaliland to get independent.
David Monda is a professor of political science at City University of New York. He spoke with U.S. Douglas Mpoga from New York. The Nigerian National Human Rights Commission, or NHRC, has inaugurated a new forum targeting rights violations in Nigeria. Timothy Obiezu has more.
The inaugural forum was held Wednesday on the sidelines of a National Human Rights Commission, or NHRC, meeting to review the state of human rights in Nigeria. The initiative is a partnership between the NHRC and the European Union. Officials say the forum, comprising of various human rights groups, will be responsible for ensuring greater protection of civil liberties in Nigeria and serve as a unified platform for rights defenders to interact and address common challenges. Anthony Ojukwu is the executive secretary of the NHRC.
We are gathered here not only to discuss the current state of human rights in Nigeria, but also to start to chart a way forward.
The meeting comes amid a recent spate of human rights violations, including a crackdown on anti-government demonstrations in August and the prolonged detention of minors who took part. The delegates also discussed digital rights, privacy protection, gender-based violence, and child abandonment by parents. The NHRC said security forces were contributing to human rights violations in Nigeria. Hilary Obuna is a senior advisor to the agency in Nigeria.
The majority of these violators are the Nigerian police, the military, bandits, and parents of children. We also saw an upsurge of sexual and gender-based violence, but that is not as worrisome as 4,300 child abandonments.
Meanwhile, the Nigerian police and military have not responded to being named as violators of human rights. But last week, the NHRC found the military culpable for infanticide and extrajudicial killings during a 2016 operation in a remote village in northeastern Borno State. The NHRC also raised concerns about the growing threat of insecurity in Nigeria and its impact on the rights of the people. Timothy Obiezu, VOA News, Abuja, Nigeria.
It is time now for Daybreak Africa Sports, and here is Samson O'Malley in Abuja, Nigeria. A very good Friday morning to you, Samson.
Good Friday morning to you too, James. We begin the sport with results from the 2025 CAF AFCON 2025 qualifying matches played so far. With only a few matches left in the qualifiers, 15 teams have secured their places at the highly anticipated CAF Africa Cup of Nations AFCON 2025 set to be held in Morocco. Thursday's result on match day 5 saw 6 more nations: Nigeria, Tunisia, South Africa, Uganda, Equatorial Guinea and Gabon clinched their spots, joining a growing list of African football powerhouses ready for the tournament. The confirmed teams represent a blend of regular African contenders and rising forces in African football. Host Morocco automatically qualified alongside notable teams like Senegal, the reigning African champions, and Algeria, who secured early qualification through consistent performances. Egypt and title holders Cote d'Ivoire also bring some strong legacies to the competition, with both countries boasting numerous African titles. Several teams have made a comeback to the continental stage. These include DR Congo, Angola and Equatorial Guinea, who will look to make an impact, while Uganda and Gabon are back with ambitions to advance deep into the tournament. For South Africa, qualification marks a return to Africa's biggest football stage after previous disappointments. The qualification phase isn't over yet, as match day 5 matches continue into Friday and Saturday, with match day 6 next week set to confirm the remaining teams, rounding off the 24-nation lineup for Morocco 2025. Staying with football news, South Africa Football Association President Danny Jordan has been granted bail of a little over $1,000 following his arrest on charges of fraud and theft amounting to $710,000. Danny Jordan, along with the South Africa Football Association Chief Financial Officer Groni Hiloyo and businessman Trevor Ntlink, appeared in the Specialized Commercial Crime Court in Palm Ridge on Wednesday. Magistrate Philip Venter set the bail at a little over $1,000 each, with the state not opposing. The accused claimed that the arrests are an abuse of process with no case against them. They face 7 charges, including fraud and theft, related to alleged misuse of SAFA funds between 2014 and 2018. Lefore Lerefolo, a former NEC member of the South Africa Football Association, says the allegations are not surprising.
So the allegations are not a surprise. The surprise is that the NPA has found substance enough and says that there is a case for people to answer. But beyond the surprise, it's a little bit tragic.
And now to rugby, where Uganda will face Kenya on Saturday in the 2024 Elgon Cup decider, hoping to overturn a 27-25 deficit against the Kenyan Simbas for their first triumph in the two-nation competition since 2015. And that's it for this Friday's edition of Daybreak Africa Sports. I am Samson O'Malley in Abuja, Nigeria. It's back to you, James, in Washington.
Thank you, Samson. Have a nice weekend.
And that's it for this Friday, November 15th edition of The Break Africa. We thank you for spending your week with us. For more Africa news and features, visit our website at voaafrica.com. Connect with us on all social media platforms, including Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. We are also on YouTube, where you can watch our TV shows, Africa 54, Straight Talk Africa, and Red Carpet. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa team, I'm James Barton, Washington, wishing that you will have a great weekend, and we'll see you again on Monday morning.